Welcome to another edition of the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. Tonight we feature Jolie Justice, who has served in the Missouri Senate, and she is newly elected to the Kansas City City Council. She's going to talk about reforming the criminal justice system on tonight's show. We'll follow our usual format. We will have first the talk from Jolie Justice, and then we will take a short break, and then we'll have questions from the audience to wind up the hour. This program was recorded on Sunday, the 8th of November, at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. The music you're hearing is composed and played by Fred Potter for our theme song tonight. Let's go right to the introduction of Ms. Justice and hear about the criminal justice system and what she thinks needs to be done to make it better for everyone.
Good morning, I'm Michael Duffy, a member of the All Souls Forum Committee. Welcome to the forum. It is the mission of the forum to afford a platform for the discussion of significant issues, especially those which involve ethical values in the contemporary world. This morning we have City Councilperson Jolie Justice to speak to us. The subject is criminal justice reform. It's hot in the news. We live in a time now when we put many bodies in cages. We're number one in the world in terms of jailing people. What with Ferguson and the other civil rights issues around the country over the past year, this is now something that has come to the fore in our attention. Jolie Justice has worked first in the Senate and succeeded in passing some preliminary reforms along this issue. Now that she's a member of the council, she's also giving this matter some attention. She's become an expert in this field. Please welcome Jolie Justice to address this issue.
Good morning, thank you so much. So Barack Obama, Carly Fiorina, Bernie Sanders, Ted Cruz, and Hillary Rodham Clinton walk into a bar. What do they sit down to talk about? What do they all have in common? And I wish I had a funny punchline here, but the reality is it's mass incarceration. It's the one issue that, despite all of the gridlock in Washington, D.C., we are actually starting to see individuals get together and talk about. They know it's a problem, they disagree on how it became a problem, and they want to fix it, even though they may not agree on how to fix it. But because of this synergy, we are at a time in our country where we're actually starting to talk about mass incarceration and the destruction that it's having on our country. So what is mass incarceration? People throw it around all the time. There's been a lot of speeches lately about it, and a lot of folks say, well, what exactly is mass incarceration? You know, just like the terms climate change and immigration reform, mass incarceration is actually a phrase that's an umbrella for several interconnected concepts. The crux of the issue, however, is that here in America, the land of the free, we have earned the disturbing distinction of being the world's leading jailer. While we only have 5% of the world's population, we actually incarcerate right now 25% of our citizens. It's really quite astounding when you take a look at it. 25% of the world's inmates come from the United States of America, and we have only 5% of the population. So how did we get to this point? Well, for years we waged wars on drugs. We enacted three strikes and you're out laws. We had the mentality of sentencing laws where you lock them up and throw away the key so that we could be tough on crime. What we never did along this journey over the last 40 years or so was stop and check how much this was costing our society and whether our wars were actually winning or losing. So what does mass incarceration mean? What does it look like? Here's the picture I want to paint for you right now by the numbers. Today in America, we have over 2 million people in prison in the United States today. And when you add that with the number of folks who are either in local jails, on probation or parole, we actually have over 7 million people who are under the control of the Department of Corrections somewhere in our country. 7 million people. The federal prison population has increased by almost 790% since 1980. As of 2012, we had at least 3,278 people who were serving life sentences without parole for drug, property, and other nonviolent crimes. Here's what it's costing the state of Missouri. In 1994, our appropriation, the amount of money that we spent on the Department of Corrections in Missouri, was $216,753,472. By 2010, it had tripled, and we were spending $670 million just on incarceration and Department of Corrections in the state of Missouri. When you look nationwide, the United States spends $80 billion a year on incarceration. And if we want to try to fix it, if we want to try to go back to the numbers before this started, well, let's look back to 1972. At the time, in 1972, U.S. incarceration rates were about 161 people per 100,000 people who were in prison. If we wanted to return to that rate today, we would have to let 80% of our prison population out in order to get to those numbers from 1972. And unfortunately, while we have seen crime rates drop in the United States over the last 20 years, there's new research that shows that none of that, or very little of it at least, had to do with our incarceration policies. In fact, it was completely unrelated policies and frankly, societal events that led to our lower crime rates. It had nothing to do with our mass incarceration policy. So I want to give you a little bit of history to explain how we got to where we are. And actually, mass incarceration is a triumph of bipartisanship in the United States. It's the one thing that the Republicans and Democrats figured out how to do and how to do well. The political roots actually reach back to the 1960s, when escalating crime, race riots, campus protests, and assassinations fed a real sense of lawlessness in the country. And of course, it was Richard Nixon who was the first major national figure to embrace the loss of law and order as a major problem, and he embraced mass incarceration as the solution. And from that moment on, the two major political parties have been trying to out-tough each other on crime ever since then. And once it became bipartisan, there was absolutely no slowing down. There was no foil in this process. There was no one to argue with. Both sides agreed, lock, stock, and barrel, that they were going full forward on incarceration as the response to this perceived lawlessness. Of course, then comes Ronald Reagan, who dramatically expanded the quote-unquote war on drugs. We had the Willie Horton impact on the 1988 presidential election, which helped deliver George H.W. Bush to the presidency while suffocating any chance of criminal justice reform in Massachusetts. Senator Ted Kennedy championed the use of mandatory sentencing guidelines. He worked with Strom Thurmond to secure the Sentencing Reform Act's passage in 1984. And Bill Clinton's 1994 Omnibus Crime Bill, which passed Congress with strong support from Joe Biden, Ted Kennedy, and other major Democratic lawmakers, added $9.7 billion in funding for new prisons and prison guards, at the same time cutting funds for education and other evidence-based treatment for our inmates. So it was really politics that got us to where we are now. And what are some of those policies and politics and things that we've done over the last four decades that have resulted in the numbers that we've seen today? Well, let's start first with the war on drugs. Over the past four decades, the United States has committed more than $1 trillion to the so-called war on drugs. But the effort has not significantly decreased drug use at all. It has not significantly impacted drug supplies, and in fact, it has filled our prisons and it's spawned a proliferation of drug-related violence across the globe. More than anything, the war on drugs, however, has been a war on communities of color. The racial disparities are staggering, despite the fact that white and black people use drugs at the same rate. Black people are being jailed on drug charges 10 times more often than white people. Racial bias, both implicit and explicit, keeps more people of color in prisons and on probation than ever before. One in three black men can expect to be incarcerated in his lifetime. Compare that to one in six Latinos and one in 17 white males. This is not just a war on drugs, it's a war on communities of color. What else has led to our mass incarceration problem in the United States? Well, part of it is the increased police power and militarization of law enforcement. racial profiling, stop and frisk policies, use of deadly force, militarization, civil asset forfeiture. All of these things feed into the mass incarceration beast. And a true national dialogue really did not start about the consequences of this police power until the death of Michael Brown and the subsequent riots in Ferguson, Missouri last year. These issues are complex, and they will require major societal shifts in order to start to address the consequences of the policies. And near the end of my speech, I'll be talking a little bit about how we can start to address those issues, some of the things that we're doing right, and some of the things we still need to work on. What are some of the other problems that we have? Well, we have a public defender caseload crisis nationwide, but particularly in the state of Missouri. We are woefully underfunded in the state of Missouri. Our public defenders have a caseload overload. They are overworked and underpaid. They're expected to handle cases far outside the recommendations of the American Bar Association. And then, of course, we have the problem of prosecutors. Now, I need to make a caveat here because I was actually raised by a prosecutor, and I would be in a lot of trouble if I didn't say that not all prosecutors are the same. We have some amazing prosecutors in the state of Missouri and across the country who are doing the right thing, who are charging things the way they should, who are reaching plea agreements that make sense, who are not bringing charges when that is the appropriate course of action. But one of the problems that we do have is that prosecutorial discretion does result in a lot of people ending up in prison. I would argue that prosecutors are the most powerful individuals in the criminal justice system. They actually decide whether to bring charges, what charges to bring. They decide what plea agreements are made. And if it appears on balance that prosecutors are getting more aggressive, they are. They're bringing more felony charges, not just in the state of Missouri, but across the country. 20 years ago, prosecutors brought felony charges against about one in every three arrestees. Now it's something like two in three. That produces more plea bargains and a lot more people in prison. The next issue that we have when it comes to mass incarceration is sentencing. Mandatory minimum sentencing laws led to a throwaway the key culture that became cruel and devastating for many communities across the country. We have a problem in Missouri on inconsistency across the state. So in Missouri, we have 114 counties plus the city of St. Louis. That means we have 115 prosecutors in the state of Missouri. Additionally, we have 45 judicial circuits, and each judicial circuit has its own set of judges and its own philosophies towards sentencing. One study showed in Missouri that prison sentences as a percentage of all criminal dispositions ranged anywhere from 11% to 49% among various circuits. That means that one out of every 10 people found guilty of a crime was sentenced to jail in the lowest sentencing circuit, but five out of 10 were sentenced to jail in the highest sentencing circuit. The average length of sentences also varies greatly across the state. The average sentence in our lowest sentencing circuits is 4.5 years, but it's 9 years for our highest sentencing circuit. This disparity among the circuits across the state crowds our prisons, it strains our criminal justice system and our budgets, and it creates huge holes and disparities across our community. Additionally, we do a really good job of over-incarcerating nonviolent offenders. In the mid-1990s, the number of nonviolent offenders in Missouri prisons was 7,461. By 2010, it had doubled to 14,204. In 1994, the number of new commitments for nonviolent offenses was 4,857. By 2010, it was 7,220. This is a huge problem. But we have to have some solutions, and that's where I want to head now, is talking about how we're going to try to fix this thing. The problem is that unlike healthcare or immigration, no single piece of legislation can fix this across the nation. We have a criminal justice system that includes 50 different state systems plus a federal system over the top of all of that. It has been said by one commentator that in order to fix the mass incarceration problem, it can only die by 1,000 cuts. Our system is so vast that any single reform may seem very inconsequential, but to the contrary, even the modest and incremental changes that we're making here locally and across the country, when applied to such an enormous population, actually have a huge world of difference. So what are we doing here in Missouri? Let's start with all of the things we're doing right. First and foremost, we've got our specialty courts. For over two decades now, Missouri has been a leader in this nation on specialty courts. And you may have heard terms like drug courts, mental health courts, DWI, veteran, fathering courts. These are courts that focus on intense judicial oversight and focusing on the issues that led to the inmate appearing in front of the court in the first place. If someone has an addiction problem, we focus on treatment. If someone has mental health issues, we get them the help that they need. So these are really evidence-based programs that are working. And actually, what's pretty exciting about it is they're working incredibly well. More than half of our inmates who enroll in the drug court program in Missouri graduate, and the recidivism rate is only 10%. Now let's compare those numbers of 10% recidivism rate to our numbers for folks who just go straight to the Department of Corrections. If you spend one day in the Missouri Department of Corrections, your chances of reoffending are 41.6%. So spending one day in the Department of Corrections means you are 41.6% chance more likely to go out and reoffend. And of course, the cost is staggering. It costs at least $16,000 a year per prisoner to incarcerate someone in the state of Missouri. The money we spend on specialty courts is a fraction of that, and it actually keeps us safer. So we are starting to see in Missouri that this makes sense, and we are putting more resources into specialty courts, and I'm very thankful that's something that Missouri has gotten right. And as successful as our drug courts were, Jefferson City did not start talking, though, about criminal justice reform in the true sense until Chief Justice Ray Price gave an amazing State of the Judiciary address in 2010. He laid out all of these facts and figures to a Missouri General Assembly who had really been ignoring the issue. Now, here was what was great about that. At the time, we had, in 2010, a legislature that was heavily Republican. And here was Chief Justice Ray Price, who had been appointed to the Missouri Supreme Court by John Ashcroft. This was not a liberal standing up in front of these Republicans saying this is something we need to do. This was someone who, from a very conservative point of view, said this is something we have to get done. It is morally wrong, and it is breaking our bank, and we are not safer because of the way we are handling our criminal justice system. After that address, it really lit a fire under the Missouri legislature, and we actually were very, very excited when we found out we got a huge grant opportunity from the Pew Charitable Foundation, who came into Missouri and for a year worked with us to produce what became known as the Justice Reinvestment Act. It was really a unique opportunity where we brought in judges, Department of Corrections, probation and parole, criminal defense lawyers, prosecutors, folks from across the state, including the legislators who carried the bill, and we all sat down together and we really got to the crux of the problem here in the state of Missouri. It was really an amazing process, and we learned a lot of things. We learned, for instance, that over 50% of new entries into the Department of Corrections in the state of Missouri were for technical parole violations. So more than 50% of the people who were entering our prison system were not entering their prison system because of a crime they committed, but because of a technical parole violation. They had either had a dirty drug test, they had failed to check in with the parole officer, and instead of handling that in the evidence-based way of giving swift and certain punishment on the front end, we were sending them to Jefferson City to enter our Department of Corrections system, and then of course when they came out, they were more likely to reoffend. So it made no sense. So what we did is we figured out that we needed to start to address the issue from the swift and certain punishment angle. We decided that if someone had a parole violation, rather than going straight down to the Department of Corrections, we would do some shock jail time, maybe a weekend so that they could keep their job and stay in their family unit, maybe evenings, those sorts of things, so that we could not fill up our Department of Corrections facilities and have to build more prisons, but keep people in the community where they are taxpaying and able to contribute to their communities and their families. We also did another thing with that where we actually cut parole time in half. If you are an offender who has 30 days of successful parole time, you get 30 days knocked off of your parole. So you could actually cut your parole in half, which resulted in fewer people under the Department of Corrections, which meant we had fewer people going to prison and more people being productive taxpaying citizens. Now, while these were huge successes, I have to say that we left a lot of things undone. Sadly, there were a lot of ideas that had been successfully implemented in much more conservative states than Missouri. Texas, Georgia, Hawaii, Arkansas, several places had gone through a very similar process and really implemented a lot of meaningful sentencing reform. Missouri did not get quite that far, and I'll tell you why. We have a law and order state, as you may or may not be aware. We have a current governor who spent 16 years as attorney general, the chief law enforcement officer of the state, and he spent 16 years putting people in prison and making sure that he was tough on crime. We had members of the committee who, while very well-intentioned and wanted to make a change, were actually leaving the committee after the close of the legislative session to run for office, and they wanted to make sure that they were seen as tough on crime. And because of that, we had folks who were scared to make some of the tough decisions that legislators in other states had made, which is really frustrating, but it leaves a window of opportunity open for us, and we know what changes are still needed in Missouri, and there's actually a path to getting that done that I'm going to address here in a few minutes. After we finished the Justice Reinvestment Act, we then went full throttle on a criminal code revision. Let me tell you a little bit about this. So a basic criminal law in the state of Missouri was actually enacted in 1835, but there was not a modern criminal code as we sort of know it now until 1969, when then Attorney General John Danforth initiated the formation of a committee to draft a modern criminal code. That process took 10 years. The first bill was filed in 1976. It was sponsored by a young state senator at the time named Ike Skelton. So Senator Skelton actually carried that bill, and unfortunately for the state senate, but great for the country and the state of Missouri, was actually elected to Congress before the bill actually passed. But it went ahead and passed in 1979, and so over a 10-year period from 1969 to 1979, we enacted our first modern criminal code. And then for the next 30 years, the Missouri legislature did everything in its power to completely water down and make a confusing mess of the criminal code. In a race to see who could be the toughest on crime, we enacted laws to cover everything. There are laws in the state of Missouri that I think you might be surprised exist. What was the result? Well, we had a confusing criminal code. It was scattered all across our revised statutes. It was completely out of date. The sentencing in the code did not reflect the crimes as they were being charged. And so in 2008, the Missouri Bar began to revise the criminal code. And they started by putting together a committee of criminal defense lawyers, including public defenders and prosecutors. And they put everybody in a room and they said, "We want you to figure this out." Well, that part, as you might suspect, was not quick and easy. Criminal defense lawyers and prosecutors trying to come up with a consensus document on how we should charge crimes and what crimes we should have in the state, that was a long process. So for 5 years, and I remember I was at the very first meeting and I thought this is gonna take a very long time, but for 5 years those folks sat in a room until they came together with a consensus document and they said to the Missouri legislature, "This is what we need." So in 2012, the Missouri Bar came to the legislature and they said, "We want you to pass this revised criminal code. This is a consensus document. Everybody agrees on it. Just take it, pass it, no big deal." Well, the first thing the Missouri Bar did is they went to legislators on the Senate and the House side to try to find a sponsor. And they quickly found that there were not very many folks who were willing to step up and be a sponsor of it. Number one, it was 1,200 pages. As a matter of fact, at the time it was filed, it was the largest bill in the history of the Missouri Senate. No bill had ever been that large. There at the time, I believe in 2012, were only four lawyers in the legislature. There were three Republican lawyers and one Democratic lawyer, and I was the lone Democratic lawyer in the Senate at the time. And all of the Republicans said, "Thanks, but no thanks. I don't want to be the sponsor on that." And then the Missouri Bar came knocking on my door and said, "Would you be willing to file this bill?" And I said, "Sure, why not?" I don't think I had any idea what I was signing on to that day in 2012 and what an odyssey it would become. But in 2012, we filed the bill, and we had a House version as well. It was Representative Stanley Cox on the House side, and he was the chair of the Judiciary Committee. And as far left, as far to the left as I was perceived as being, that's how far to the right Stanley Cox was perceived as being. And so we had two folks on complete opposite ends of the ideological scale who decided to take this journey and make sure that we had a really strong bill that worked. So it was filed in 2012. It was didn't go anywhere. Refiled in 2013, made it out of the House, but died in the Senate, as things often do. Then refiled in 2014, and sometime, if anyone ever wants to sit down and have a beer, I will tell you the odyssey of how this became law. But it is truly, I think at the end of it, we were all assigned superhero labels, and we were considered the Criminal Code Avengers, because it really was a story for the ages on how we actually got that done. But what it does is fundamentally change how we are going to charge crimes in the state of Missouri, how we're going to have plea agreements, and for the first time in almost 40 years, we have a comprehensive modern criminal code. It's streamlined, it's modern, it's orderly, it's all under the same chapter, which is amazing. We have new classes of felonies and misdemeanors to reflect how the crimes are actually charged in the state. We actually reduced assaults from 27 different types of assault that we had. We had an assault for everything in the state of Missouri. If you assaulted a utility worker, it was different than assaulting an average citizen on the street. We had assaults for police officers and correctional officers and doctors and bus drivers. We had so many different assaults. Now we have three. Makes complete sense. We started to make some sense on the sentencing. At the time that the criminal code was brought to us, we had the exact same punishment for bad check writing as we did for involuntary manslaughter. So if you wrote a bad check, felony bad check, you were facing the exact same jail time as if you had an involuntary manslaughter conviction. That didn't make any sense, and so we were able to go through and fix those things. We actually have given prosecutors new tools to go after folks who commit crimes against children, especially sex crimes against children. Those are incredibly hard to prosecute because of obviously the issues that come with having a child as a witness, and we gave them some tools that they needed to crack down on some of the most dangerous people in our society. And one of the biggest things that we did that I think is going to be the most helpful through all of this process is we really got at some of the drug sentencing problems. We removed the parole ban for prior and persistent offenders. Before the criminal code was passed, we had a situation where if you were a prior and persistent drug offender, you were not eligible for parole. You had to spend the rest of your life in prison. We also removed jail time for first-time marijuana users, and this was actually probably the most controversial piece of the whole bill. We worked out, Stanley Cox and I, every single detail except for this last piece. And my argument and the argument of, frankly, the prosecutors and the public defenders is we don't want to put people in jail who have no other charges, they don't have a weapon, it's just marijuana possession. We don't want to put them in jail. We want to have a crime available. We want to maybe make a fine. They will have a misdemeanor on their record, but we don't want them to face jail time, which allows us to do two things. Number one, it keeps the prisons freed up, but two, it helps with the public defender caseload. Public defenders only represent individuals below a certain poverty line level, if they are actually facing jail time. If no jail time is faced, we don't have to use those resources. So this was something that everybody wanted. But Representative Cox was very adamant that he did not want to, quote unquote, decriminalize marijuana. And so we had to negotiate, and I hope no one ever does a search on what my Google searches were the night we were trying to iron this out, because I was Googling things like how many joints are in 10 ounces, how many joints are in 12 ounces. Finally, I found a kid on my staff that I called my director of marijuana policy, and I just started texting him, and I said, okay, we've got a college kid who's walking down the street and he's got two joints in his pocket. How many ounces is that? What we finally came up with, though, was a new crime, which is does not face any jail time whatsoever, which basically says if you have up to 10 ounces of marijuana and you have no other charges, you will not be facing jail time. So that was a big leap forward. It was not where we wanted it necessarily to be, not even where the prosecutors wanted it to be, but it was where the General Assembly was comfortable getting to. And that's of course, what politics is all about. It's the what's the art of the possible. It was an incredibly difficult process because we had to convince folks that this was going to be something that would not come back and haunt them, that we were not doing anything dangerous. We had to make an effective date of January 1st, 2017, so it hasn't even taken effect yet. We had to get into a full-on bipartisan war against the governor in order to get it passed and signed ultimately. We had finally at the very end an agreement from the governor that he would not veto the bill. He did not sign it either, but in Missouri, unlike the federal government, a non-signing by the governor means the bill becomes law as opposed to being thrown out. So that was ultimately what we were able to get accomplished in Missouri. So what is next? We've done some incremental things. We've got the drug courts and the specialty courts. We've got the Justice Reinvestment Act and the criminal code revision. What's up next? What do we still need to do? Well, first and foremost, we have to go back to the sentencing reform. There is no question that we need to revisit what we started with the Justice Reinvestment Act. And a lot of folks, I think, would say, well, if you just let all of the nonviolent offenders, or if you just let all of the folks who are in the Department of Correction for drug crimes, just let them out, then we'll be able to really reduce the numbers of folks in prison. And the answer is, unfortunately, not quite that simple. 90% of America's prisoners are actually held in state institutions, and only 17% of these inmates are in for drug-related offenses. So that's less than 1 in 5. So even if we just open the door and let everybody out at that low-level drug dealer, a pot smoker type person, we would still have a huge mass incarceration problem. The good news is that the numbers are dropping, but nationally, even if we let out everybody across the whole country, we would only drop our prison population from about 1.5 million to 1.2 million. So there's really not going to be a huge result from doing that. So as nice as it sounds, we still have a lot of work we need to do. And one of the things we're going to have to do is start having conversations about releasing folks who also have violent crimes on their records. And this is a hard thing to do. It's a hard thing for political reasons. Folks have to run for re-election, and no matter what any politician tells you, their number one priority is to get re-elected. And if you go out and campaign and say, I am campaigning to let violent criminals out of prison, you are probably not going to get re-elected. And so this is something that's incredibly difficult, and it's something that we're going to have to work a whole lot on to make sure that we do it in the right way. So one of the things that we're doing now on the federal level, and it's happening to a lesser extent through some of these criminal sentencing projects that we've done across the country, is starting to look at individual folks. And that's really where we need to go with this. We need to move away from our anger-based sentencing that completely ignores the cost and effectiveness of what we're doing with the inmates. And we need to focus on what the individual inmate needs. What does this person need? Is it education? Is it treatment? Is it mental health services? Once we go in this direction, we will be able to make very smart decisions about who needs to be in prison, because there are people who need to be in prison. There is no question that there are people who need to be locked up and kept away from society, and I fully understand that, and I think the country understands that. But there are individuals that, if you get the resources to them that they need, can be released from prison in a successful way, and we need to start making those decisions. We do that right now in our juvenile justice system in the state of Missouri. We actually have one of the best juvenile justice systems in the world. And one of the things that we need to do is start to take some of those best practices and use them not just for our juvenile population, but for our entire population. We need to look at eliminating or even reducing mandatory minimum sentences so that we could save people from years and years behind bars and get them back into society as productive taxpaying citizens. You know, one really low-hanging fruit that a lot of folks are looking right now is actually civil forfeiture reform. It's kind of a complicated thing, so I'm not going to go into incredible detail on it, but it is something that we could fix that would actually help to rein in some of the police power and the militarization that we have. Civil asset forfeitures have been justified as a way to go after drug dealing organizations. These forfeitures allow law enforcement agencies to take an organization's assets, usually cash, and then use those assets to fund more anti-drug operations. The problem is that there have been many, many, many documented cases in which police abused civil asset forfeiture, including instances in which police took cars and cash from individuals because they suspected them of using them for illegal activity, even though they could never prove that they were using them for illegal activity. And in these cases, it's actually up to the people whose property has been taken to say that they were not doing anything illegal, instead of the traditional legal protection and standards which police have in cases of wrongdoing, where there has to be reasonable suspicion before you can move forward on this. So that civil asset forfeiture, coupled with the federal program that gives surplus military-grade equipment to local law enforcement, has resulted in an increased police power. And it can be argued that these programs actually encourage police to focus on drug crimes because of the financial rewards that come back to law enforcement agencies. That is one thing that we can tackle as a country, and I think it would be relatively easy to handle first. And as I mentioned, every incremental change that we make, we actually have huge steps forward as far as the populations that we're addressing. We also need to encourage best practices for law enforcement, including leadership and training. And here's where I want to take a moment to give a huge kudos to our own police chief, Daryl Forte, and what he's doing here in Kansas City. He is to be commended. He is looking at issues of community policing and hotspot policing rather than this stop and frisk mentality that many organizations and law enforcement agencies across the country have gone to. It's how we use these programs that really affect a community. We are doing right now something called Focused Deterrence in Kansas City through our KC No Violence Alliance, and it is having tremendous results. We are seeing for the first time a dramatic drop in gang or group-related crime. This is something that many people thought was not possible, and it's really impressive that this Focused Deterrence model is starting to work, and we need to continue to do that here in Kansas City and across the country. We need to focus on recruiting and retention and diversity within our police forces and law enforcement agencies. When your police force looks like the community that you live in, you are going to have a respect that is two-way, and that's something that's incredibly important. And then training. I think training is incredibly important and something that cannot be underestimated, and the Kansas City Police Department does a very good job. After the shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, there were a whole series of bills that were filed in Jefferson City that had to do with deadly force and the use of deadly force. And the police department asked several of us over to the training facility, and many of us went through a simulator where we actually had to be, we were approached by active shooters. And I had in full disclosure, I am not a weapons person. They handed me the fake pistol or weapon, and they said, just hold it like you'd hold a regular weapon. And I said, well, I've never held a regular weapon, so I don't know how to hold that. The seconds that are in play when an active shooter is involved are unbelievable, and what our police do to put themselves on the line every day is something that takes tremendous training, and we do a very good job of it here in Kansas City, but it's not just on the deadly force use. You know, on Friday night, I had a very great opportunity to go to the Kauffman Foundation for a fabulous performance by the UMKC Conservatory called Crescendo. It was a fabulous evening where we heard some amazing, amazing performances by our young students here in Kansas City. And what many people didn't know is that while we were in the auditorium listening to this great performance, an actual huge protest was popping up right outside. We had folks from the University of Missouri campus, coupled with a few folks from the UMKC campus, who were in town to protest Tim Wolf, the president of the University of Missouri system. And there were almost 50 students who came to the Kauffman Foundation, or Kauffman Center, rather, and they came in, and the police were called, and the students were moved out to the public area on the sidewalk. They were asking to speak to the president. The president of the university did go out and speak to them, as did the chancellor of UMKC. And when they were done speaking to them, they came back inside and the students stayed on the sidewalk. And with the absence of the administrators, the students started kind of lashing out at our police department, our Kansas City Police Department. But because of their amazing training, they realized that what they needed to do at that point was disengage and stop the escalation. So rather than a huge brouhaha, or worse, forming right there on Broadway, what happened was is that the students actually were allowed to continue to do their peaceful protest, and the law enforcement officers, because of their training, actually de-escalated the problem. That's the type of training and leadership that we need. We need law enforcement officers who use discretion and who are really understanding a situation and assessing it and not just reverting back to the brute force that we see in so many police departments and law enforcement agencies across the country. A couple of other things we need to tackle. We need to continue on juvenile justice reforms. The juvenile justice reforms that we could do can actually reshape the lives of our young people and make it so that from the beginning, from the very start of their adult life, they have the same level footing that those folks who have privilege enough to be to have a home life that maybe has a higher socioeconomic background or a better education has. And one of the things we can do that is raise the age of liability. Right now in Missouri, you are an adult for criminal purposes at age 17. That means that we have juveniles in our adult prisons, and that is something that needs to stop. We need to work on life without parole for kids. All the science shows that kids' brains are different than adult brains. They have not formed yet. It does not make sense to lock someone up for life without parole at age 14. It simply does not make sense. We need to fix that in the state of Missouri. We need to work on the minimum age for certification. Right now in the state of Missouri, there is no floor on who can be certified as an adult. So if you have a 9-year-old who allegedly commits a heinous crime, he or she could be certified to stand trial as an adult. That does not make sense. Kids are different. We need to treat them differently. We also need to change the behavior of prosecutors. We need to add some accountability. You know, one of the things that happens right now is we have prosecutors across the state who are elected to their office, and they also want to get reelected, and so they go out and try to show that they're tough on crime. Their counties are the one paying their salaries, but unfortunately it's the state of Missouri that's paying to incarcerate folks. So some of our highest incarceration comes from some of our very rural counties. Maybe if we started to make a system, and I'm just throwing ideas out here, and they need a lot of work, I understand, but maybe we do something where you can only send X number of people from a specific county to the Department of Corrections every year. If you want to put 10 people in, then you need to figure out how to get 10 people back out. We need to start having those hard conversations. We need to start making the counties be accountable. If we can get this done, I think it would be very difficult for the price tag when prosecutors go over the number of folks that they send to our Department of Corrections. Those sorts of accountabilities, those sorts of consistencies across the state would be incredibly helpful. We also need to increase our funding for our specialty courts. And then finally, we need to look at prison reform. One of the things we really have not started talking about is how we treat our inmates when they are incarcerated. As Michael said at the beginning of this, we lock people up like animals in cages, and then we expect them to come out and not act like animals when they get out into society. And that does not work. We have to add education. We have to add treatment. We have to add mental health services. We need to make sure that we curtail the use of solitary confinement as a form of punishment. And then we need to work on reentry. We need to make sure that people are able to work when they get out. We need to make sure that there is a path to restoration of civil rights. In the state of Missouri right now, you cannot get anything expunged from your record with the exception of DWI, bad checks, and credit card fraud. That does not make any sense to me. And by the way, the only reason we have the bad checks and the credit card fraud piece is because a very wealthy Republican donor convinced a Republican senator to file a bill. Because in the state of Missouri, if you are a felon and you are an ex-offender, you cannot possess a weapon. And there was a very wealthy man in Northwest Missouri who wanted to go hunting with his grandson, and he could not do that because he could not possess a weapon. And so he actually was able to convince a Republican legislator to file a bill to change the expungement laws to get his bad check charges expunged. Now, that was great for that man, and I'm glad that he can go hunting with his grandson now, but the reality is that we have thousands upon thousands of Missourians who need that same chance, but who don't have access to funds to go down to Jefferson City and lobby on these things. So we need to make sure that we are looking at expungement, and fortunately the Missouri Bar has said that they're going to look at that next, that they're going to give the exact same scrutiny to the expungement issue that they gave to the criminal code revision. And finally, I want to say that there is bipartisan cooperation in the air right now. This one-upsmanship that got us here, it's actually turned into a transpartisan coalition. We've got folks all over the political spectrum. One of the biggest groups is called the Coalition for Public Safety. It's a new alliance of political groups and think tanks. It includes left-leaning organizations like the ACLU and the Center for American Progress. It also includes conservative and libertarian groups like Freedom Works, Americans for Tax Reform, and Right on Crime. We've got on one side Koch Industries and the Koch brothers putting in tens of millions of dollars into this effort, and on the other side we have George Soros, who just cut a $50 million check to the ACLU to help decrease our prison population in the United States by 50%. These are really important things that are happening, and it's happening here in Missouri. And so one of the things that I want you to be on the lookout for is Missouri is being looked at as a possible ground zero for these reforms. It may be through an initiative petition, it may be through the legislative process, but the whole country is looking at Missouri so that we can be leaders and we can set the pace and the tone for how the rest of the country responds to this issue. And so with that, I want to say that ultimately, we are not going to address these issues just through some of these reforms that we've done. We're going to have to take a hard look at the racial and social and economic reasons that helped build the problem. But we are on the right path, and we are ultimately moving towards a society that understands this is wrong, and now we want to fix it. And with that, I'd like to open it up to questions.
That was City Council Member Jolie Justice, former Missouri State Senator, talking about the criminal justice system here on tonight's All Souls Forum. We need to take a short break. We got some messages for you that we need you to hear. Stick around for the second part when we have some rather interesting and provocative questions from the audience for Ms. Justice. You're listening to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. We'll be right back.
Nora Puyon, pioneering organic chef, on Sprouts, Thursday at noon.
A community health worker is a bridge between traditionally underserved populations and needed health information, support, and care, as well as important basic and social services. It's a new job here in Kansas City, but a much needed one. Find out about it, how you can become a community health worker, or how they will help improve public health. This week on the Heartland Labor Forum, Thursday 6 p.m., rebroadcast Friday 5 a.m.
First question, Jeff.
In the fairly recent past, there's been a lot of national as well as local attention to the issue of a lack of facilities to treat mental illness. So you can't, it's hard to divert someone from prison or jail or to keep people out of prison and jail if there is an insufficient amount of services that are available for treatment. Could you talk a little bit about the distance between what we need to have in terms of treatment facilities and what we do have?
Absolutely. And I'll say the bad news first, which you just hit on. We are using our jails and our prisons as mental health facilities right now. I mean, that's just that's how we're using our jails and prisons right now. And everybody understands that we cannot fix this problem by simply having fewer people in prisons. We have to make sure that we address it. Now, one of the things, and one of the main reasons that I wanted to run for local office after all that time in Jefferson City, was because I know on a local level we could actually start to address these issues. So one of the great things that we're doing here in Kansas City that I'm incredibly excited about is an issue, or I guess, a concept called the crisis center. And one of the things that we are going to do is we are going to have a crisis center so that when police are arriving and you've got someone who has a problem, rather than hauling them off immediately to our city jail or hauling them off to Truman Medical Center, we're going to take folks to a crisis center and evaluate what the situation is. If they need drug treatment, we are going to have drug treatment available. If they need mental health services, we're going to get them on the path to mental health services. Now, of course, all of this means we're going to have to continue to push for the funding from the state and the federal level, which I understand is a monumental problem, but I do believe that we are making the right steps in Kansas City to move in that direction. And we as a community, like we so many times do, are also looking to our private sector to help fund these things because our state and federal government have failed us.
Good morning. Good morning. As always, I appreciate the fact that you choose your words carefully. I would make one observation, and that is people with mental illness are simply not being treated by being caged. And there really needs to be a very sharp way to make the point that there is no sense in which jails substitute for mental health. My question is to make note of the fact that you've come back to the region. What is the likelihood that we can make Kansas City, the region, as ground zero? Because this tension between the rurals and the urbans does not appear to me, you would know better, to have any foreseeable likelihood of being relieved in the near term.
I think you've hit it exactly on the head. One of the things that, as I mentioned, one of the reasons that I wanted to get involved locally is because I saw that some of the most effective and progressive things that were happening, whether it came with criminal justice reform or poverty reduction or education, was all happening at the local level. And that's why I think we have to do it this at the local level, because they're not going to do it at the state and they're not going to do it at the federal level. The problem we're going to see, and this is where I want to scare everybody for a minute, the problem we're going to see is we are going to continue to have pushback from Jefferson City every time we step forward and do something progressive as a city. We are going to see an increasing number of attempts to preempt our city government, just like we saw with the minimum wage, everything from plastic bag bans to smoking for kids under the age of 21, all of these things. Every time we do something like that on a city level, we're going to see pushback from Jefferson City. And so we have to get to where we are having our community leaders, not just the elected officials, but our business owners, explaining that as a city, we want the state government to stay out of our business. Just like the state government wants the federal government to stay out of its business, we would like the state government to stay out of our business. And so I think we can continue to move forward, but we have to be very cautious because we are going to see a lot of attempts by the state government to preempt what we do here.
Good morning. I just recently moved here from Massachusetts, and in Massachusetts there's a movement towards restorative justice programs. I'm just curious to know what's going on in Missouri.
We actually have, and there may be folks in this room who have participated in the restorative justice movement, and it has been so far really been locality by locality. So you'll find it in a county, robust and full. And it was interesting, one day as I was coming back from Jefferson City to Kansas City, just at the end of the week, I stopped in Sedalia, and the Democratic Club there asked me to come and talk about criminal justice issues. And unfortunately, there were no Democrats left in the middle of the state, so they had to get the Kansas City Democrat to stop on her train ride home. And but I walked in, and I was blown away at the restorative justice program that they had on the ground in Sedalia, Missouri. I see it in pockets. I see it in juvenile justice settings. It has not really gone statewide. It really does seem like it's just prison by prison, city by city, and then, like, you know, you've got the situation where you've got it in the juvenile justice system, but not necessarily statewide. It's something that I would like to see spread further.
I come down from St. Joseph, and probably even in Kansas City, they've heard of the businessman who waved his gun, ran his car into crowds, and he gets charged with a misdemeanor. And the little girl that had the fight on the playground is charged with felony assault. And I've had many battles with Scroggins in St. Joseph over what he's done to especially young women. And I don't know, is there any way you can ever correct this or fight other than just vote him out? And nobody even runs against him, so I see no chance.
Yeah, unfortunately, one of the things that we've tried to do is the question essentially was, what do you do about a prosecutor who is continually using his or her prosecutorial discretion in ways that don't make sense? And, you know, one of the things that has been thrown out as far as that concerned is, maybe do we need to move to a prosecutor's are not elected but appointed? That is one idea. Another is, frankly, the idea of circuit attorneys. Missouri does not have this. We actually have 115 prosecutors. We have a lot more than that, actually, because, for instance, Jackson County has the lead elected prosecutor, but then we have however many prosecutors that work for Gene Peters Baker, who, by the way, is a shining example of how a prosecutor should run an office. And she's an amazing woman, and I'm proud that she is my prosecutor. But what we need is definitely that accountability. If you've got someone who is continually making bad decisions, you need to find someone to run against him or her. That's unfortunately the only option we have now. Moving forward, we need to look into possibly circuit attorneys rather than county attorneys, and we need to look into that accountability piece. And then some of the things that we did with the criminal code will also help, because we actually, you know, every now and again we'd get into the middle of debating something and they'd say, well, prosecutors would never do that. And I'd say, I understand that most prosecutors wouldn't do that, but you'll have that one guy in California, Missouri, who decides he wants to send someone to prison forever because they've had a fight on a playground. And so while I trust that you, prosecutor across the table from me now, would not do that, I can't leave that to risk. So the criminal code, every step of the way when we were debating that, we did not give on something unless we got something in return. And so I think that once that goes into place, that will give us some assistance. Any other questions? Well, we got one more.
Pardon me if I'm repeating something. I don't hear all of it. But are you working on the whole business of the exorbitant bail prices? That woman that had the two kids down in the mine, $72,000.
You know, thank you, Sister Pat. We didn't talk today at all about bail reform, but that actually is something that needs to be discussed. There are certain crimes that you don't even qualify for bail, and there are others that, frankly, are completely not fair. And the disparity, frankly, among people of color, it's unbelievable. And so that is something that we as a society need to look at. I think it's a tough one. But it's something that the conversation has started in Jefferson City. I did not know that there was a lobby corps for bail bondsmen, but there is, shocking. And they came out in full force, and the prosecutors did as well. So it's a complicated discussion, but it needs to take place. Thank you for bringing that up.
How does the new code provide for cases where a gun was used in the commission of crime?
So, we still, unfortunately, have it really doesn't change how we do things right now. When a gun is used in the commission of a crime, you still charge the added charge onto it. The problem that we have in the state of Missouri is that the voters have passed, and you've probably seen this in the paper recently, a constitutional amendment reaffirming our support of the Second Amendment, which, of course, we never doubted that Missouri supported the Second Amendment. But the problem is now that we're going to see more criminal defense lawyers who are going to come forward and use that now as a shield. And our concern is that we are not going to be able to, in the future, charge everything the way we need to charge it, that we're not going to be able to keep guns out of the hands of felons. These are very difficult issues that we're going to see. You know, in Kansas City, we can't ban conceal carry because that's a state law, but we did say that you cannot open carry. You cannot walk around Kansas City, Missouri with a gun strapped to your leg like it's Dodge City. Unfortunately, this new law that was passed, frankly, says, sorry, you can't have a law that is more restrictive than what you have on the state level. One of the things that we really are going to have to address as a community is how we pass laws relating to weapons that impact our community and still be able to get those through Jefferson City. That's going to be a very difficult thing moving forward, and I suspect this will ultimately be something that goes to the United States Supreme Court before it's fully resolved.
You've been listening to Jolie Justice talking about reforming the criminal justice system on tonight's version of the All Souls Forum. This program is produced each week and edited by Barry Lee. Thank you to Rita Norton and her staff at All Souls who help us produce this program every week. The theme music that you hear at the beginning and ending of every show is composed and performed by local musician Fred Potter. You can also find this program in podcast form a few days after the broadcast. It is on KKFI's website at www.kkfi.org, or you can just Google KKFI. And when you get to the front page, just click on the podcast button. There'll be a drop-down box that will direct you to the podcast that you want. We have quite a number of All Souls programs archived there that you might want to check out if you missed them, or if the topic interests you. So that's it for this week. Come back next week, same time, same place. This has been the All Souls Forum here on KKFI.
You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. This is David Gromberg. And if you don't know who that is, don't worry about it. I have no idea who you are.